A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Zinsberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today, my guest is Lynn Tillman. She's one of my favorite guests, actually, and one of my favorite writers. The occasion is the publication of The Complete Madame Realism and Other Stories. It's published by Semia Text. Now, let's begin by acknowledging that Los Angeles, which is the city where this show originates, is said to be the city with the largest number of museums in America. This includes museums of horror films, museums of architecture and design, every kind of museum. And Madame Realism is a consummate museum goer and a traveler to museums. What is her purpose? She's not exactly an art critic.
No, she's not exactly anything in particular. I began to write her as a character, as a kind of retort, especially to Sir Realism.
Sir and Madam Realism.
And it was a way for me to think about what I was seeing, what I was going to see, museums and many other objects, books I'd read, but mostly visual matters, not as through an eye, the pronoun I, but through a fictional eye, which allowed me a lot of leeway. Because that character is not me. It is someone who I, in a sense, control. But she will have opinions and thoughts that perhaps I, Lynn Tillman, wouldn't. And fiction is, I think, a terrific aid in allowing the imagination to roam. And I do when I write Madame Realism pieces.
She travels. She goes to museums like the Museum on Ellis Island, museums of immigration. She is really asking questions about what the culture has to say about itself when it asks to be considered formally as, what would you say, the housing of treasures.
The housing of treasures, and in a sense, a canonical view of what those treasures or moments in history were. So, for instance, the Ellis Island Museum, I had the good fortune of being able to go to that island when it was disused. Somehow the ferry, which also stopped at the Statue of Liberty, let you off at Ellis Island.
I saw it, too.
You saw it, too.
Oh, it was very intense and frightening.
And Ellis Island, I think, stopped being used maybe in the 30s, maybe before then. But much of the furniture was still there. If you walked around and there were no guards to stop you, you could just walk into this massive place that had been a place of great threat to people coming to the country. Were they going to be allowed in or not?
Not only that, but, you know, we all have stories, yes? My uncle was detained. he was thought to have a diphtheria-like disease, and he was held on Ellis Island in their medical facility there for weeks. And he gets here and gets put into detainment.
That must have been terrifying for him,
to the family, because they didn't know English, and they didn't understand what they were being told.
And what was happening then. My family went through there, too, my grandparents. So I was walking around the halls with a couple of other friends in the late 70s, when it was disused, and pushed open a door, and it was the office where they had examined people, and instruments still lay on the cabinet and on the examining table, and of course dust covered it, and it was a bit like a horror show. Then years and years later, I was asked by Art in America to write about it, and I went on the tour, and it was this sanitized, full of information, how many immigrants had come through when, how many immigrants of this kind or that kind, and covered all over with facts and drawings and different ephemera, what people had left, suitcases and so on. And it was a kind of creation of the present around the past. It was a sort of theme park around this immigration.
Exactly.
It was a theme park, and it had none of that sense of what a break from your home country and coming into America would have felt like. That was gone.
People today forget that it wasn't the welcoming place they're romanticizing today. I think Madame Realism is as relevant today as she was when her adventures started to appear in Art in America in the
1986. Yeah.
But she has several compatriots now, including a writer, a woman named Paige Turner. Now, who is Paige Turner? And she differs terrifically from Madame Realism.
Yes, yes. She is not at all Madame Realism. Paige Turner is a writer. I've never written a writer before or since, really. And I was curious to try to do that. And it started with an essay, with a story that dealt with hysteria called To Find Words. And that was when Paige Turner first came about, because hysteria is very interesting when you think about what happens in psychoanalysis, where words that might be frozen in you might suddenly come out. And so hysteria, in a way, is a kind of writer's medium, almost, to play with. So in To Find Words, and I wrote this when I was earlier in my career, and I was trying to figure out what voice meant. And the voice is a problem for Paige Turner. With what voice will she write this? With what voice will she write that? And in many ways, I write in opposition to a certain idea. And one idea has been that a writer has a writer's voice. There's a voice for a writer. And I don't believe that. I believe that your characters have voices. You create a character, and the character is basically created by the voice that you give that character. So Paige has to figure out the voice she's going to use. And so she tries writing different stories. And there are very different voiced stories that she begins To Find Words.
I first encountered her in a very elegant literary magazine called Conjunctions. And in that particular piece, she was a woman trying to find a voice for the language of love. She was in a state of, would you say, love panic?
Love panic, some kind of frenzy, yes.
She has written a 24-page approximately piece about unrequited love.
And so, of course, writing about love for any poet or writer is both inevitable and repellent. How do you write about love? All the great writers have written about love. What can you add? If you can add anything, what can you copy? What can you never do yourself? So I decided to bring in lots of other forms of writing, from Richard Hell lyrics to Shakespeare to John Donne to Laura Riding Jackson. And in between, Paige Turner's writing letters, presumably to her lover, in which she twists and turns in trying to say how she, in her case, loves him. I interspersed or interjected these other ideas about love, these other signs of love.
I'm talking, by the way, to Lynn Tillman. Upon the publication of The Complete Madame Realism and Other Stories. Now, these pieces find their place somewhere between essay, letter, fiction. They are of all kinds of origin, and they seem to want to say to the reader, now, come on, fiction isn't just fiction anymore. In fact, you say at a certain point, a story is a way of thinking, and we think in stories. And what does that mean?
Well, when I wrote that a long time ago, again, I was thinking of my opposition to so much anti-narrative talk that I was hearing. And I thought always rather simplistic ideas of what narrative can do. And to narrate is simply to tell. And stories are kinds of tellings. And I think you can do all sorts of things with that. And fiction, coming from the Latin facere, simply means to make or to do. And these are, in some sense, doings and makings. And I like combining all different kinds of ways of thinking into a story. To me, a story is can be a kind of notion of conversation also.
It's almost like a writer's highly trained stream of consciousness that reveals to us that genre can't contain writing anymore. We have to be willing to let writing be expressive of an act of thinking about writing, but not exactly self-consciously. These are strangely unself-conscious pieces.
How do you mean unself-conscious? I mean, I'm not interested in the self that's writing them particularly, no.
No, but I mean when Paige Turner is essentially singing her love lyric, she's not singing it saying, I've got to stop this right now, or explaining to us who she loves, where he is, will he answer, what the condition of the narrative is. It's there.
Yes.
It's present, generating its own rules. And the rules are very exciting to find, even when, as in the case of Paige, you have the feeling that she's stuck. She's stuck in love, and it's like being stuck in the briar patch.
Yes. And the phrase, or the sentence, I should say, "I love you," is no one owns that. The I is a shifter, of course, always. And my sense is that that we don't love, that we don't love differently. That it's a very curious thing. Here's this great feeling that can come upon you of love. And it's probably the most common feeling human beings have, though each one of us might say, "Oh, it doesn't really exist," or "I don't believe in love," or "I renounce love." And yet, somehow, if we experience it, and I think most people do, hopefully, many people only experience self-love, which is sad, but I think it's a very similar feeling. Passion is passion to all of us.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Lynn Tillman about her book, The Complete Madame Realism and Other Stories. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Lynn Tillman, sometimes known as the beloved Lynn Tillman, about her latest book, The Complete Madame Realism and Other Stories, a unique weaving of fiction with short stories, essays, and philosophical explorations that defy categorization. Now, the last section is the newest of these, and it's really the most complex mix of genres, because sometimes it verges on art criticism and then veers away. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, because it's true of your work in general, what is it that makes you want to escape from the formal ideas that you set up?
Escape from the ones I myself set up?
Yes.
For me. Ah, that's such a good question, Michael. I think that there's a tremendous an impulse in me not to be myself, or not to always do what I have done, and always to doubt what I think, and to be aware that there are other ways to think about that. Sometimes one gets caught up in thinking only one thing. For instance, I was thinking only one thing for the last year, that Hillary Clinton should be our president. That's what I was thinking, and no one could take that thought away from me. But generally, when I have a thought, I often think about how you could think about that differently. And it's a great pleasure for me to have this space, this writing space, in which to do that. Because if I were to do that with friends, if I were to be constantly changing a position or reflecting on it or refracting or being as ironic as I can be about something, it would be troubling in a relationship, because a relationship depends upon
stability
in some sense. That's why I love humor and comedy. The one place where you can always do something different is if you, within a relationship, is if you can say something funny and laugh, and the other person laughs too. That's where, in many ways, I think I can let another part of myself break into the part of myself that I am much of the time with that person or other people.
The first of these newer pieces is called drawing from a translation artist. And what's fascinating about it to me is that it runs through a whole set of ideas about translation, but the new wrinkle is that it's also an original work of art. And you bring to bear the idea that Borges, the great Latin American writer, has about his character who writes Don Quixote. He writes Don Quixote today by immersing himself in 17th century Spanish, and Borges's narrator tells us this is a far more original book than Cervantes's is, because just think how difficult it was to write it today.
Yes.
And now this piece is going a bit further and saying that ideas about art are themselves works of art. By the end of this section, you talk a bit about Harold Bloom, who says that a work of criticism is a work of art. Now, you're being very ironic, yes?
Mm-hmm. I wrote that story because there was an exhibition at the Drawing Center on drawings made from photographs. So there were, on the walls, at the, this was at the Drawing Center, on the walls were these wonderful representations of photographs, that some of which were well known to us, maybe the Kennedy assassination. I'm not sure if that was it, but in the nature of that. And also for the last 10 or 15 years, I've been thinking about translation and the ways, in multiple ways, that in some sense, everything is a translation. All writing is a translation. All art is a translation. Everything is in a way abstract. And that is something that I think a lot of contemporary artists are working with. And then there are some theorists who are questioning whether the translation should be made of books, because they're such different kinds of books. And years ago, Jonas Mekas and P. Adam Sitney believed there shouldn't be subtitles on foreign films because you should be looking at the image and not reading the words. Fortunately, that didn't occur, because otherwise most of us wouldn't have gone to these foreign films. But in some sense, they're absolutely right. You know, if you're reading and not looking at the image, you're not also seeing the film. So I kind of was riffing on all of these different ideas of translation, which I think are very pertinent today in all sorts of forms, this global world we're living in. How do we translate contemporary art from China into the way in which a Western eye looks at contemporary art?
And it seemed to me that ultimately, by bringing us back the Madame Realism stories, we were looking at Madame Realism through the most recent set of new eyes, the eyes of transposed time.
That of course, that will always translate a work differently.
Yes.
And without that idea that the contemporary translates the past, then with it, you understand that a work of art changes with the changed time, and that's not a bad thing. That's the thing that keeps it alive.
Now, in previous incarnations, the works have been accompanied by photographs mm-hmm. of the work of art they comment upon. But this is a book in which the pieces stand alone and comment on one another. And so, you know, there's now an interplay between the world of Madame Realism the world of Paige Turner and the world of several miscellaneous art critics who, for instance, speak about the work of Cindy Sherman and others, and the idea of looking and saying what you see when you look is the new form, it seems to me, of narration here. It's narration as seeing. And the thing seen is being kept off the page so that we're experiencing these stories with an entirely fresh eye.
Well, hopefully that will be the effect. I wrote them with the idea that they could stand alone, that they didn't have to depend upon a picture representing the work. If that works, I'm happy. I mean, anything, I think, a reader can imagine anything. You give a reader, an intelligent reader, a sensitive reader, a space in which to imagine, and they'll love you forever. No, but I mean, yes, why not? I mean, one of the reasons I resist certain kinds of description of characters is that sometimes if you define a character so closely, the reader can't find a way to glom on somebody she or he would like to see there, or something mm-hmm. that is an association.
It blocks the possibility of projection.
That's right. And I don't want to do that, because I think one of the great beauties of reading is the way in which we can project into something.
I've been talking with Lynn Tillman, author of The Complete Madame Realism and Other Stories, published by Semiotext. Thank you, Lynn, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Complete Madame Realism and Other Stories at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Otessa Moshfegh is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.